From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today, country music singer and songwriter Margot Price.
Sometimes I'm a genuine wolf.
Price will sing some of her songs for us. To pay for studio time to record her first album, Price and her husband sold their car and pawned her wedding ring.
The ring, it did kind of hit home, and my husband said, it's just material possession, it doesn't matter. While I agreed with him, I still liked my wedding ring with the chip in it, so he eventually went back and got it out of the hawk for me.
Now, she's nominated for a Grammy for Best New Artist. We'll also remember Dick Miller, the character actor best known for his role in Gremlins, who died Wednesday at age 90. And I'll review Amazon's new three-part mystery series, The ABC Murders. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Grammy Awards are coming up next weekend, and one of the performers up for a Best New Artist Grammy is our first guest, Margo Price. She's a country music singer-songwriter based in Nashville, and her latest album is called All American Made. When it came out in 2017, she spoke with Terry Gross and performed some of her music in the studio. Rolling Stone described All American Made as, quote, one of the most political country records in years, a declarative honky-tonk manifesto of small-town farmer populism and working-class feminism, unquote. Meanwhile, in her Twitter bio, Price describes herself as a songbird, thunderbird, and jailbird. In her song Weekender, which we'll hear later in the interview, Price sings about the weekend she spent behind bars after she was arrested for driving under the influence. That song is on her debut album, Midwest Farmer's Daughter. Her roots in the American Midwest are an essential part of her music, as you can hear on this track from All American Made. The song, Heart of America, is about her parents losing the family farm when she was two.
Sometime back in 86, the big banks took the throne. They asked that every local farmer try to dry his own corn. But the men in suits had a bigger plan than to let it be our own. When the crops came in that spring, they were blown. And Neil and Willie tried so hard in battles they have gone. But that was still long after the much bigger war had been won. And be a hard-working man. At the end of the day, if the rain it don't rain, if the bank it don't break, we just do what we can.
That's Heart of America from Margo Price's new album, All American Made. Margo Price, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming to our show and for bringing your guitar with you. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. You were, according to your songs, you were two when your family lost the farm, so you probably have like no memory of actually living on the farm. Can I ask what the circumstances were that led to your family losing the farm?
Yeah, I was about two or three, and I do have a couple kind of vague memories of my grandparents packing up all their things in their home and getting rid of their dogs that they loved so much and all their animals. So there is a little bit of a memory there, just knowing the gravity of it all, just how much it affected everybody. You know, there was a combination of a lot of things. Of course, it was big farming was coming in. The banks weren't very generous in helping out the family after a hard year. So they had been told to install these grain bins that dried their corn, which typically I guess they would ship off and have that done. So they had invested in a lot of farming equipment that was very expensive. And then a drought came, and the combination of those two things, then the bank just kind of swept it out from under them and sold it to a large corporation.
So on your first album, there's a song called Hands of Time, which is about, you know, leaving your home and hitting the road and, you know, launching a music career. And it seems very connected to the first song that we heard. Can you play? Can you perform some of that for us?
Yeah. Here's a little piece of it.
Now we're all out of town on the unpaved road. I was $57 from being broke. Kissed my mama and my sisters, and I said goodbye. With my suitcase packed, I wiped the tears from my eyes. But times they were tough. Growing up at home,
My daddy lost the farm when I was 2 years old. Took a job at the prison, working second shift. And that's the last time I'll let them take what should be his. So all I want to do is make a little cash, cause I've worked all the bad jobs and busted my ass. I want to buy back the farm, bring my mama home some wine, and turn back the clock on the crew. Hands of Time. It was kind of strange because when I wrote that and I showed my husband, he said, I don't know if that key change works or whatever kind of modulation you're doing there. It just, I don't know. I just kept playing it over and over. I said, yeah, it does. and then later everyone said it was genius, but right off the bat, I think it was, it felt a little strange.
So the song that you just did, Hands of Time, refers to your father after the farm was taken away, working a job at the prison. And so is that the job that he took?
Yeah, it was. I think it's a hard job for anyone who has it. You know, nobody wants to be in a working in a prison, but he did what he had to do to put food on the table, and him and my mom worked very hard, very modest jobs to make sure that we were never without.
Your great uncle is a songwriter. And I don't know that I know any of his songs, but he's a songwriter who went to Nashville and kind of made his way there. Did that open up any doors for you, at least a door in your mind, thinking someone from my family did this, so maybe I can do it too?
Well, for sure. We would come down family vacation and stay with my Uncle Bob and my Aunt Helen for a couple days. And, you know, he had gold records hanging on his wall. He's written hundreds and hundreds of songs. He wrote for George Jones, a song called Writing on the Wall. You know, he wrote for Reba. He wrote for Charlie Pride and Tanya Tucker. And there's so many people. And he had a, you know, just a regular job. And he was living in Iowa. And his wife was supportive enough when he said, I want to go to Nashville, I want to be a songwriter, that they picked up everything and moved down here. And it did seem to be this impossible dream that he had conquered. And but, you know, I do think that probably my mother thought that he could open all the right doors for me and there would be a nice, smooth transition. And I came to his house. He lives in Green Hills, and I played him some songs like the first week I was here, and he sat there real quiet and didn't say anything. And I said, well, what do you think? And he gave me the best advice that he could. He said, you know, go home, throw away your TV, throw away your computer, just sit there and just keep writing. And it hurt my feelings, but I needed that tough love, you know, to tell myself I did need to keep working at playing and hearing other people's songs and seeing what made a good song. So I started going out to lots of open mics and listening to everybody and cutting my teeth.
So, you know, in terms of like moving to Nashville to like launch your performing career there, one of the kind of central stories about your early career was how you and your husband sold the car and pawned your wedding ring so that you'd have enough money to pay for the studio time to make your first album?
Yeah, we kind of put all our eggs in one basket, and it was really scary. He just came into the kitchen one morning, and he's like, that's it. We're never going to be able to save up enough money to make the record that you need, and so I'm just going to sell the car. And I tried to talk him out of it, but he went down to Gallatin Road and sold it to CarMax. And he came home, and then we booked the studio time the very next day.
And your ring, too? You pawned that?
Yeah, we went down. I went to about three different pawn shops, and none of them wanted to give me very much because there was a crack in it, and it's missing one of the little diamonds on the side. And But they were going to give me $300, and we just agreed to get rid of anything that didn't suit us. And we did sell some music equipment too. But I, you know, the ring, it did kind of hit home. And my husband said, it's just material possession. It doesn't matter. And while I agreed with him, I still liked my wedding ring with the chip in it. And so he eventually went back and got it out of the hawk for me.
And you have it now?
I do. I'm actually looking at it. It's still got a crack, and it's still missing one of the diamonds. I haven't even went to go get it fixed.
Margo Price speaking to Terry Gross in 2017. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2017 interview with country music singer-songwriter Margo Price. She's nominated for a Grammy Award as Best New Artist, and the award show will be held February 10th.
I'm going to ask you to play a song from your new album, and this is called All American Made. It's the title song. Would you introduce it for us and play a little bit of it?
Yeah. So, yeah, this song my husband and I co-wrote, and it's been around for a minute. You know, it's funny how songs kind of change their meaning as the world seems to change them for you.
How has the meaning of the song changed?
I think there's just more weight in it than at the time that I wrote it. And, you know, we wrote it during the Obama years, and I feel like I've always been one to question the people in charge. I enjoy playing the devil's advocate and being the protagonist. And so, you know, when I wrote the song, you know, I was still upset with things that were going on. But I think, you know, America's just in such a divided, heavy place right now. And I love my country so much. I don't want to leave. I just day to day wake up and read the news and feel confused. And so this song has helped on some gray mornings.
The song has a lot of verses. Do you want to choose a couple of your favorite and play them?
Yeah. Starting after the lead, about halfway through the song, is where my favorite ones start.
1987, and I didn't know it then. Reagan was selling weapons to the leaders of Iran. But it won't be the first time, baby, and it won't be the end. They were all American made. But I was just a child, unaware of the effects. Raised on sports and Jesus and all the usual suspects. So tell me, Mr. Petty, what do you think will happen next? It's all American made.
That is Margo Price performing for us the title track of her new album, All American Made. Tom Petty slips in there.
Yeah.
This was when he was still alive that you wrote the song. Why are you asking him a question?
Well, I think there's nothing more American than Tom Petty. And so when I started writing those later verses there, I thought he'd be the person who'd know what actually is All American Made. I'll just ask him. And then, of course, I thought maybe if I asked him a question, he would answer me, and then I would get to meet him. So I was really shocked when, yeah, I mean, because the album came out on his birthday, what would have been his birthday. That was just a really hard time, I think, for people on both sides of the battle right now. Everybody loves Tom Petty.
Yeah, yeah. As you mentioned, there are so many drinking songs in country music. Not like there's any shortage of them in rock, but but country, I mean, it's just like a whole genre unto itself, the drinking song. You have a great drinking song that I want you to sing for us. It's called Since You Put Me Down, and you co-wrote this with your husband, Jeremy Ivey. Would you introduce the song for us and play a little bit of it?
Yeah, the song kind of talks about the duality and the good and the evil that we have inside of everybody. Yeah. Since you put me down.
Since you put me down, I've been drinking just to drown. I've been lying through the cracks of my teeth. I've been waltzing with my sin. He's an ugly, evil twin. He's a double-crossing, backstabbing thief. I killed the angel on my shoulder with a fifth of Evan Williams when I found out you were never coming home. On my shoulder, since you left me for another, I'm trying to turn this broken heart to stone.
That's a great song. I really love your voice. You know, in terms of like moving to Nashville to like launch your performing career there and try to get known as a performer and a songwriter, in one of your songs, you talk about, you know, starting to sing in the bars and running with the men. When you got to Nashville, was it like a real like guy scene that you became part of?
Typically, there's a lot of men out there doing it. You know, that line was, it was kind of a double meaning with, you know, it kind of meant, you know, just hanging out with the guys and the bars and the songwriters and whatever, but it was also just about infidelity and, you know, it was a weighted sentence.
Notice how I didn't even pick up on that because I'm that naive.
Okay. No, not at all. I don't think I've ever said that to anyone, so now the secret's out.
Yeah, and you also write, you know, not only about singing in the bars, but drinking a lot. And I was wondering, not in terms of the other meaning of running with the men or just hanging out with men, I was wondering if there was a period where you felt like you almost had to drink more because I think sometimes women are supposed to show they can hold their liquor.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think there's a problem with alcohol in America, and it's advertised in a way that, you know, you see it and you're like, oh, that's going to make me sexy and that's going to make me cool. And it's the opposite is true. But I think, you know, when I first was let loose from, I had pretty pretty protective parents and they liked to keep a short leash on me. So when I first moved to college, you know, there was a lot of binge drinking there. That was just what a lot of people were doing. And I was definitely known to be able to hold my liquor. You know, then I kind of stepped away from that and I started smoking grass, which just felt like I was more productive and happier. And then, you know, when I moved back to Nashville, a lot of people refer to Nashville as a drinking city with a music problem. And so, you know, the bottle is talked about a lot in country music. And I, you know, moved here when I was 20 and I started working in a bar. So yeah, it's always been a slippery slope. And of course I medicated pretty heavily with booze after I lost my son.
This is
not the way to handle things. Yeah.
Your twin baby, you had two two twin sons, and one of them died at 2 weeks. And I just want to say, I know this is about 7 years ago or so, but I want to say how sorry I am. I imagine that kind of grief never leaves.
Yeah, it's been a tough one. You know, I feel much healthier now than when it first happened, and I've done a lot of personal work to try to move past it. But there's not a day that goes by that I wouldn't trade, you know, all my career and everything just to have him back. It's not easy.
Margo Price speaking to Terry Gross in 2017. Last year, during a concert appearance in Nashville in November, Margo Price announced that she and her husband are expecting a baby this May. We'll continue Margo Price's conversation with Terry Gross after a break. We'll also pay tribute to Dick Miller, the character actor familiar from Roger Corman films and the movie Gremlins, who died Wednesday. And I'll review the newest TV adaptation of an Agatha Christie novel starring John Malkovich. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Well, I've been traveling so long that I can't go back, 'cause I'm too far in. I got my ticket and my bags are packed, and I miss my child, Lord, I miss my friends, but even they quit calling me on the phone asking me how. To blame for the shape that I'm in. Maybe I'm insane, but I'm leaving you again.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at indeed.com/hire. And from Creative Planning, an independent wealth management firm whose advisors are fiduciaries, legally bound to act in their clients' best interests. More at creativeplanning.com/NPR. Wealth management redefined.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2017 interview with country music singer-songwriter Margo Price. She's nominated for Best New Artist at this year's Grammy Awards, to be held February 10th. Her latest album is called All American Made.
I had asked you, before you came on the show, if you would be willing to play a song that seemed very out of character for you, because I love to do that to musicians, to have them play something that we wouldn't think that they liked or that you wouldn't associate with them in some way. And you communicated through email offering to do a Kendrick Lamar song, which
I know
surprised me.
I don't know
me.
If I
surprised
can do me. It. I know, I really don't. I could probably talk about it more than I could do it, but
no,
I have
no,
been
no,
trying.
No, you committed and now you have to do it.
No. I know, I've been trying to figure it out where I can make it work, and I just can't. I don't know if I can do it, but I mean, that's been the album that I have played more than anything this year. I feel like I do want to figure that out, but I...
You want to do like just a few, just a tiny little portion?
Let me see if I can. Let me see if I can figure out. I've been trying to figure it out for the, you know, I sit around and play it and joke with my bandmates that we're going to do a full band version. But, bitch, sit down. Bitch, be humble. Bitch, sit down. Be humble.
That's all I got. That episode is hilarious.
It's really funny. Right?
Like a heartfelt version of...
Yeah.
What do you like so much about Kendrick Lamar, considering his music is so different than yours?
You know, I think that DNA is one of my favorite songs off of his last album, and I've written about those same things where it's people have such contradictory elements inside of them and like weakness, you know, I talk about that and Since You Put Me Down, where it's the devil and the angel on each shoulder, you know, you kind of are arguing with yourself. But I fell in love with To Pimp a Butterfly and just his overall outlook on things, and you know, he's not afraid to speak out and speak the truth, and even when it's hard and people criticize him, I really admire him.
So you've said that your parents were afraid that they weren't sure how it would finally work out. So it's working out really good, but they didn't know that at the time. You have a song called Weekender, which is about spending the weekend in the county jail. Did that happen to you?
It did. Yeah, that was one of the lowest points. I feel like I'd been running wild for quite some time, and it was really only a matter of time before it was all going to catch up with me. And came home one night after staying at a friend's, and I tried to call a cab, and the cab didn't come. This was kind of before Uber and Lyft were really in cities, and I just made some bad. I shouldn't have driven. I thought I was fine. I gave it time. I ate some food. I waited a long time, but I ended up hitting a telephone pole in front of a couple police officers, and then thought about outrunning them for a little bit, and then I realized that wasn't possible, so I finally pulled over and walked the line, and yeah, I got a good lawyer, but I still had to go do this weekend in jail. And he had told me, he's like, oh, it's a white collar thing, it's not going to be a big deal, it's really not going to be scary. And when I showed up at the Davidson County Jail, I realized that I was in there with, you know, people who had murdered people and done some really bad things. And just being in there was an eye-opening experience in more than one ways, more than just, you know, for self-motivation to get better and never end up back there again. But it was also, it was just sad to see women who were in that situation and whose lives had taken them there.
Can you do like a verse of Weekender?
Yeah. Let's see. I went down to the county jail, turned myself in, spending all my weekends here, far from my good time and friends. Things went bad. Things went worse, I guess you know the end. The only thing I know for sure is I ain't going back again. They took me down to cell block B after stripping off my clothes. Put me in a monkey suit and threw me in the throes. Like a rat in a maze, a cow in a herd, or a sparrow with a broken wing. Now I know the reason why the caged bird has to sing. 'Cause I'm just a weekender in the Davidson County Jail. My old man ain't got the cash to even go my bail. Should've listened to my mama
maybe quit my life of sin before I went back sliding again.
This one is a, this one might be my favorite.
Bed is hard and the room is cold. My cellmate's got a cough. She takes her meds and sleeps all day. Got 6 more weeks till she's off. She said she beat her boyfriend up while high on crack cocaine. Now she sits and watches her young life go down the drain. 'Cause she's just a weekender in the Davidson County Jail, and her old man ain't got the cash to even go her bail. She should've listened to her mama, maybe quit her life of sin before she went back sliding again.
Oh, thanks for singing that. That song, yeah. Weekender, is on Margot Price's first album, which is called Midwest Farmer's Daughter. Her new album is called All American Made. I was wondering if you'd like to maybe preview a new song for us that you have not yet recorded.
Yes, I would love to. This is a song that I wrote just pretty recently here, and it's kind of about a seeing the billboard on the side of the road. This says 1-800-JESUS, and you want to call him because you've got to ask him questions, but you know, you don't know if he's actually going to answer, because sometimes it feels like you're talking to no one when when things are going wrong. So here it is, a hello operator. 1-800-JESUS.
Lock me up all by myself, throw away the key. I can't stand to read the news or turn on my TVs. Carnivores, religious wars, and they do it for the money. Rich folks eating 4-course meals while welfare kids grow hungry. Hello, operator, could you get me on the phone? Like to speak with Jesus sometime if he's ever home. Heard that I call him up most any time I want, but every time I ring him, well, he never picks it up. So I went out to the diners, the dance halls and the bars, hanging out with the hippies and wondering where you are. Down every stretch of highway, I'm looking for my home. Call 1-800-JESUS from the billboard on the road.
I'll save the third verse as a surprise here for the future.
Okay. You'll probably record that at some point.
I think so.
Margot Price, thank you so much. And thank you for being so generous and singing and playing for us. It was really just wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Margot Price speaking to Terry Gross in 2017. She's nominated for a Grammy Award as Best New Artist, and the awards show will be held February 10th. Coming up, a salute to Dick Miller, the veteran character actor who died Wednesday at age 90. He got his start in Roger Corman films, including A Bucket of Blood and the original Little Shop of Horrors. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from ProQuest, creators of ProQuest One Academic, unifying journals, ebooks, videos, and dissertations across disciplines in one mobile-enabled interface. ProQuest.com/go/NPR. And from Progressive Insurance, committed to offering a streamlined shopping experience where home and auto can be bundled together. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
This is Fresh Air. Dick Miller, the character actor who appeared in dozens of films by Roger Corman and his many protégés, died Wednesday. He was 90 years old. Corman cast him in such low-budget genre films as A Bucket of Blood, The Terror, The Trip, and the original Little Shop of Horrors. Several of the directors who grew up watching Corman's movies, or got their start working for him, later paid tribute to Miller by casting him in their films. Martin Scorsese gave him the part of a club owner in New York, New York. Miller had a small part in Jonathan Demme's Swing Shift. And Joe Dante cast Miller in every one of his films, including Gremlins and Gremlins 2, where he plays the neighbor who comes to visit just as the gremlin invasion begins. Terry Gross spoke to Dick Miller in 1990. Before he made films, Dick Miller lived in New York, where he was writing, producing, and directing for TV and theater. He went to Los Angeles hoping to write screenplays, but met Roger Corman, who offered him a film role instead.
He was doing his, a second film, a picture called Apache Woman with Lloyd Bridges. The guy who introduced me said, "Dick's a writer. You need any scripts?" He says, "I got plenty of writers. I don't need any scripts. I need actors." I said, "I'm an actor." He said, "Okay, I'll stick you in a movie." I played an Indian in my first picture. About halfway through, he asked me, he said, would you like to play a cowboy? I said, "You're doing another movie already?" He says, "No, in the same movie." I said, "You're kidding." He said, "No." He said, "Come back next week, you'll play a cowboy in town." So I wound up playing a cowboy and an Indian in my first movie. And Donnie came close to shooting myself in the final shootout scene at the end.
Did anybody in the audience notice that it was the same person who was a cowboy and an Indian?
I don't think so, since it was so early. I mean, there was nothing to recognize. Nobody could say, "Oh, I've seen him before." A lot of dark makeup and some nose plugs. And the difference was, you could tell. If you look close, if somebody said, "That's the same guy," you'd say, "Oh, of course it is." But I don't think anybody was looking that close.
Did you have to learn how to ride a horse for the movie?
Oh, yeah, the old Hollywood story. Can you ride? Yes, you know. Can you jump out of an airplane? Sure. Without a parachute, of course. You know, they ask you all kinds of things, and you got to lie and say, "Of course I can do that." I had ridden a little up to that point, horses in stables in Central Park and places like that, and dude ranches, but nothing like cowboys and Indians. And I just figured, I've seen it done, I can do it. And that's pretty much how I learned. I learned on the first picture.
You played the lead in the 1959 Roger Corman movie, Bucket of Blood, and this has become a real cult classic. It was the leading role. You were a waiter in a beatnik coffee house. And you become an artist by covering first your dead cat in clay and then by killing people and covering the corpses in clay and passing it off as sculpture. And once this artist becomes really acclaimed, you also become quite the hipster. Was it fun to spoof the hipster in the movie?
Well, it was made at the height of the coffee shop era. Everybody was going in for espresso.
You mean the coffee house, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the basic idea behind the picture was the hipster coffee house groupies at that time and the people who hung around and the no talents and the talents of that era. I think later on Roger Corman made a picture called The Trip about the first, you know, big psychedelic outings that were going on, which was a little more serious. But it was also meant to cover that genre of what was happening at the moment. I love making Bucket of Blood. I think it still stands as my favorite picture.
The movie was shot in, I think, 5 days. Can you give us an idea of how you made a movie that quickly?
Well, 5 days was not as tight as it seemed. They were making TV half-hour shows in 2.5 days, and people who had that down had that type of... that was a finger snap.
Right.
People who had that down at that moment could make movies that fast. When I started with Roger, we were making Westerns, and we would make them in 6 days. And that seemed like a fair amount of time. And later on, we got an extra day, a seventh day or an eighth day. And I thought, this is great. What a luxury. So by the time we got around to making a Bucket of Blood, 5 days was kind of a press. But most of the picture was shot in two sets. So it wasn't that much of a push. It's a matter of learning the technique. I think later on, when he made the famous Little Shop of Horrors, which was supposed to have been made in 2 days, and actually 2 days and a couple of spare nights, that also wasn't too much of a push. The people who were involved in it seemed to think, well, 2 days, okay, we'll try it, and if it doesn't work, we'll add another day.
But I understand you were offered the lead in Little Shop of Horrors, but you turned it down. Why didn't you take it?
I have a track record of turning down a lot of pictures for a lot of unknown reasons, even to myself. I think at that time, and I was hungry in those days, I would turn down jobs and say, I don't want to do it. I turned down Little Shop of Horrors because I had just finished doing Bucket of Blood, and I thought I was being asked to do the same character again. This was before they had sequels. If I had known it was going to be a sequel or a sequel character, I probably would have done it and been very happy. I kind of regretted it over the years. I turned it down kind of on an artistic level. I said, I've done this part. I don't want to do it again. Give it to somebody else.
How come you stayed with Roger Corman for so long? And how long was it?
Let's see. When I went to work for Roger, I was not that serious about my career. I still didn't know if I wanted to be a writer, although I had stopped writing the minute I worked in as an actor in movies. I just said, this is kind of nice. I found it very easy to work for him. He was doing a lot of work. I mean, as many as 5 or 6 films a year. So I stayed with Roger 5 or 6 years and wound up doing about 35 films for him in that period. The work was easy. It was constant. I didn't have to look for jobs, which is the most difficult part of being an actor, I think. Mm-hmm. And I found myself, every couple of months, I'd get a call from him and say, we're going to do another picture, and we got a nice part for you. And as the roles got better, it became easier and easier to stay in that position.
Did he always write a role for you?
I will always be grateful to Roger for the fact that he didn't write roles for me. He let me do almost any part that came up. I think the opening picture was kind of the sign of which way we were going. I played a cowboy and an Indian. Well, you're not going to typecast me that way. You know? You're not going to say, this guy does West, he does cowboys only or Indians only. I suddenly found myself playing rocket scientists, demented busboys, leading men, villains, everything. And he never said, you can't do that part. You know, he'd say, can you do this? Can you do that? I said, I can do anything. And I found myself in 35 pictures playing practically 35 different roles. I don't think many actors get that kind of opportunity.
Well, Joe Dante has cast you in every one of the movies that he's made. And I think that a lot of the people who became well-known directors after working for Roger Corman ended up casting you in their films. You know, Joe Dante is an example. Alan Arkush, you were in his Rock and Roll High School. Help me out with this. What are some other examples?
Okay, Marty Scorsese.
Yeah, New York, New York. You played a club
Jonathan
owner.
Jonathan Demme, Jonathan Kaplan.
Mm-hmm. So were you self-conscious
Steven
about
Spielberg,
this?
Oh, really? to overlook Steven.
Were you self-conscious about this, knowing that people were paying homage to you in a way? I mean, they'd seen you in all these movies. Do you know what I mean? And your parts were, in a way, an homage to yourself.
I was flattered, and I think probably Scorsese was the first one who summed it up for me when he was doing New York, New York. I went to see him, and I said, what do you want me to read? And he says, I've been watching you since I'm 13 years old. You don't have to read for me. You know, he says, you got the part. Bobby De Niro's going to come in here, and we'll try some ad-libs and see how if you got that feeling with each other, which we did. And that was it. And I suddenly realized there were a lot of guys out there who started watching me when they were young teenagers and spent 10, 15 years watching me. And now they're grown up and they're producing and directing and writing and they want to use me. And I really was flattered. It took a while for it to reach me, but once it did, I was truly flattered.
Dick Miller speaking to Terry Gross in 1990. The familiar character actor died Wednesday at age 90. Coming up, I review the new Amazon TV miniseries The ABC Murders, based on a novel by Agatha Christie. It stars John Malkovich. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli. Amazon Prime Video imports a new TV miniseries today, a three-part mystery drama called The ABC Murders. It's the latest adaptation of a novel by Agatha Christie, starring one of her most famous fictional detectives, Hercule Poirot. And this time, Hercule is portrayed by John Malkovich. Next year will be the 100th anniversary of the publication of the first Agatha Christie novel featuring Hercule. He's an acutely observant crime solver in the Sherlock Holmes tradition. He has a thick Belgian accent. And he's been played on screen by such actors as Albert Finney, Peter Ustinov, and, most famously, David Suchet, who ended up starring in all the stories in a lengthy series presented here by PBS. That series ended 5 years ago. But now, in a new British production imported by Amazon Prime Video, Hercule Poirot lives again. This time, the novel is The ABC Murders, the 13th in this particular Christie series. It's adapted by Sarah Phelps, whose writing and production credits in the UK in the last few years alone include the classy TV adaptations of Christie's And Then There Were None, The Witness for the Prosecution, and Ordeal by Innocence. And The ABC Murders introduces, as Christie's famously imperious Belgian detective, an American actor, John Malkovich. The ABC Murders is set and was originally written between the two world wars. It's 1933 in England, where posters proclaim such anti-immigrant sentiments as, "We must stem the alien tide." Poirot, an immigrant himself, had come to England and succeeded admirably as a detective. But the man we meet now is basically retired and long past his prime. The new police inspectors don't respect him, much less consult him. He dyes his beard to look younger, a temporary affectation that only makes him seem more outdated and desperate. But when someone begins taunting him with typewritten letters, posted daily from different cities and threatening a series of random murders of alphabetically chosen victims, Poirot is the first to take the letters seriously, letters which make it clear that the killer knows the detective well, down to his newly blackened beard. Poirot, always the smartest guy in the room, is the first to recognize when the police arrest the wrong man, pointing out the error of their ways, even as Detective Bunce, played by Shane Atwool, is taking the suspect into custody.
It isn't him. Use your eyes, Detective Bunce.
Alice Asher's neighbor said he was always threatening his wife. That he said he was going to cut her throat. That he was going to cut her head clean off. And he practically did cut her head clean off.
I was caught.
Like you don't know.
To inflict such a mortal wound with a weapon inadequate to the task requires great strength. Monsieur Asher is a dipsomaniac. He has delirium tremens. He could not strike a match, let alone wield a knife. And where is the blood? He's not washed his hands. There would be blood ingrained in the beds of his fingernails, the skin of his knuckles, his wrists, the cuffs of his shirt. There would be blood everywhere. It isn't him.
He bought some gloves, and then he chucked them after.
Mon Dieu, Detective Bunce, you are no student of human frailty. Any money he has, he spends on his demon, on alcohol. He would not buy gloves. And the cash register was undisturbed. If money were the motive, he would have taken it.
You reckon you know it all, don't you? Well, you don't. Case closed.
The case is far from closed, of course. It's just getting started, as victims with alliterative names, Alice Asher, Betty Barnard, begin piling up in various cities. The clues lead, eventually, to railway stations in the country's ABC Railway Guide, but also connect to the detective's past. Sarah Phelps adapts this particular mystery novel, taking a few liberties, and all of them are commendable. The hero is more vulnerable, even tragic, and Malkovich plays him tenderly without overplaying him at all. The supporting characters are more colorful, in fact, more Dickensian, and some of them act a lot saucier and kinkier than any character from an Agatha Christie novel. And the mystery itself? Almost a century later, it still works and still entertains. On the next Fresh Air, before states ran legal lotteries, there was the underground street version, the numbers. Bridgette Davis talks with Terry about growing up with an enterprising mother who was a numbers runner in Detroit in the 1960s and 70s. She did well and raised her five children in a comfortable home that she owned. Davis has written a memoir about her experience. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Thea Challoner directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancuri.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Alliance for Lifetime Income, a nonprofit composed of financial services organizations working to educate Americans about options for securing protected lifetime income in retirement. More at allianceforlifetimeincome.org. And from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org.